Sharon and her husband Neil are the only persons that I knew before I came to this church that were in this church. I met Sharon many years ago at a United Methodist Women's School of Mission when she was one of the instructors there. And we kept in a little bit of contact over the years, and so it was a delight to find her as a part of my congregation. And I knew from that time that she was a Talawa woman. I didn't know all that that meant. I still don't know all that that meant, but I loved hearing some of her stories. She shared some of them with you before, and I'm delighted that she's going to do that today. And then Mitzi, I think your mother died in 2012, so it was the first year I was here. I came in July 2012, and I briefly visited her mother before her passing, and we did her service here, and I learned that her mother was of Karuk ancestry, and so, of course, Mitzi is, and it has been a joy to have contact with her over these years, and her family. You will know Mitzi also as Tammy Davies Hughes' mother. So now I present to you Sharon and Mitzi.
Okay, I want to say that God of all nations, God of all kingdoms, Gualashem of all nations, Gualashem of all kingdoms. Shudet, Indian name that I took was my great-grandmother's, Shrinta. And she's a Talawa woman who survived the massacre at Yontaket. I'm Sharon Sly, Sharon Eller Sly.
We can share.
Okay.
Good morning. Ayuki, that's Karuk for hello. I am a Karuk, and I'm also part Shasta. I've had a lot of fun working on this project. It has been work, but Sharon and I have shared many laughters, and we found things that we do have in common. So I hope you'll enjoy our stories this morning.
I would like to have you right now. I guess it's not. Yes. Stop for a minute and in your mind think about what you've heard from your family about the 1800s, maybe the 1850s. Did your family have stories? Did they tell them to you? Think about it and just ponder that for a second. We're going to start with that time period, even though we know that contact with non-Indians occurred prior to the 1850s. A lot happened in the 1850s, about mid-1800s. But first contact in my area up on the coast was around, first ship that landed, I guess, was about 1820. And, of course, we had a lot of fur traders and trappers.
In the 1820s, the Hudson Bay fur trappers went up the Klamath River, and I have a great-great-grandfather who traveled with them as a fur trapper, and he met an Indian woman, and that's about five generations back that I've gathered information from. I don't have a lot of history because of the way that my family was treated. And so I did not learn the language. I did not participate in any of the ceremonies. So what I will share with you will mainly be some of the history and the stories that I've heard and where I am now.
Mitzi and I had a good time talking about this because of the same factors that kept us from knowing about our own cultures. I still had more experience with my culture because we lived with my Indian relatives and my grandma and grandpa, and they spoke Indian, and and they lived that life.
When my great-great-grandfather came up the river, he met a woman named Mary. She was a full-blooded Indian. She was blind, and she lived along the Klamath River in a one room cabin. She was born at a little place called Poonwadden, which means pond water, which is near the Somes Bar along the Klamath River. During those times that they were living there, there were many, many massacres and rapes that took place along the Klamath River, and that's probably why I don't know a lot, because it wasn't shared.
So let's have the first slide. This is probably a strange way to start out. We were just praying for peace throughout the world. And this is the way our world on the Indian side started. So you see, in 1846 to 1870, the population of California Indians declined from 150,000 down to 30,000. In 1853, you see Yontaket. That Yontaket was located, a small village on the Smith River, and that's where my great-grandmother, Shrinta, escaped the massacre. She swam across the Smith River from the south bank, and she escaped up into Oregon and didn't come back until it was safe to do so. While that was happening, women and children and old people were thrown into a big bonfire. And Grandpa talked to us about that. Grandpa told us about that. At home now, my husband and I, we have a plant that I keep in the yard because it comes from the Yontaket site. And it's kind of a memorial for me to have that plant at home.
I'm going back to the 1850s. In the 1850s, the newcomers, the miners, were really invading the territory of the Klamath area, and the Indians were told to move on. In 1853, the Indians that were living in Fort Jones were poisoned. They were invited to a party by the Army, the United States Army, and they were fed poisoned horse meat. In 1854, when the whites were met with resistance, they burned down Indian houses, and many of those houses had their winter supplies in them.
From my great-grandmother's side, the Reuben side, the boy was hit, Reuben. He became Reuben because he was adopted by one of the military men that came through. And he was adopted when they discovered him hidden in a burden basket. And the officer said, "That's enough killing. I'm going to take him as my son." And so the family name Reuben came from that point in time.
At the end of the 1800s, the turn of the century,
Before we go on, I wanted to say that between the 1846 and 1870, it says, the die is cast, and I can hardly see this now from here.
And a wave of extermination
commenced against the Indians. And that was a quote from the Crescent City Herald. If you read back through the papers of the newspapers, local newspapers, they're almost proud of the number of Indians that are killed. Slide 2. That's your slide. Can you see it?
No, I don't see any slides. Oh, wait, I do too. I can't read that. It's too tiny.
Tatatatum. Anyway, that's Crescent City. Howard quit. Thank you.
So that gives you a pretty good picture of what was going on at that time.
I would mention one other thing about Yantucket. They were in the middle of a 10-day earth renewal ceremony. So it was a spiritual gathering of more than just the local people. That's why there were so many people in the area.
Okay. At the turn of the century, my grandmother was born. She was born at Soames Bar. And at that time, many of their customs were vanishing because of the influence of the whites. The Karuk children were forced to attend school to become civilized. And there is a story in my family where one of the person's name, they only had first names, his name was Swanee. His father's name was Pete. And when he went to school in Hoopaw, he had to have a last name. So they named him Swanee Peters. And you may know that name in this community. Peters is a big name. So that's how the Peters name came about. Half-breeds were not accepted into the culture. And my great-grandmother was part white, and she was part Indian, so she was not accepted, which influenced the way that the future generations were raised. Because of that, many of the children did not learn of their traditions because they're now living in a new society.
All right. Next slide, please. This is a picture of what my great-grandfather, Wharf Charlie, and Alice or Shrinta, home and where the children lived. And if you notice there on the far right, out toward the beach, and if you're familiar with Crescent City, this is the place where there's an historical marker for Metecton Village, and that's where they lived. The city fathers decided that the Indians had to move off of that land, sort of like eminent domain, I guess. It was kind of prime beachfront property, very, very beautiful there. They said if they did not move off that land, they were going to send the kids to Indian boarding school. And my grandfather did not want that to happen, so my grandfather tore all of that apart, saving all the wood, and built his house and his sister's house on B Street, 5th and B. They bought the block. 8 Indian people bought the block. And then because they had a benefactor, or not a benefactor, a protector kind of person, said, you need to get this recorded in the recorder's office. So he went with them to the recorder's office, and you can find the deed recorded in the office, in the recorder's office in Dunlop County now.
My history is going to take me now into the 1920s when my mother was born. She was born in Wairika. Her mother raised 4 of her children in Wairika. Mom's father died when she was 10 years old. I believe he had tuberculosis, and they kept him out in the woodshed. And when he was dying, he told my mother to look after her brother and her 3 sisters. I think that's probably why she went on to become a nurse. She left Wairika at the age of 17. She went to San Francisco and enrolled in the French's Hospital. She was supposed to be 18. She lied about her age, but she wanted to create a new life for herself and possibly her children to come. My grandmother, being a widow, was very well taken care of. I remember hearing stories of always having food. This is during the Depression, and there was always venison and salmon that was brought to us by the family. Cousins and uncles always provided food. There was always food. And I think my grandmother was pretty well off in the sense that she had her own home in Wairika. Her husband was a miner, and there is a story about gold that my grandfather told my mother before he died, that there were 10 coffee cans full of gold, and he had shown her where it was buried. And so the family, myself and my sister and our spouses at one time, went out looking for that gold. We never found it. We have since been in that area, and I believe there is a housing development on it. It's over in Quartz Valley near Fort Jones, so that's kind of a family history. But my grandmother was very fortunate that they owned their own home, and she could take care of her four children.
I think I'll... Oh, there, it's moved forward. That slide is of my grandpa, Wharf Charlie's son, Fred Charles. When they came through with census, they had to have names, as she said. So my grandpa's name was Fred, and he was the son of Wharf Charlie. So he first became Wharf Charlie, and then a teacher said, "They're making fun of you. You better change that name. You should be Charles." So he became Fred Charles, and that's Martha Charles, his wife. She's Martha Rubin. And she was Martha Rubin Brooks. Her husband died, I think it was 1904 about. And then she married my grandpa, who, and at that point in time, she was selected by the families. Her husband was selected. Grandpa was going with a white girl, and he had to break up with her. And he married Martha because that was his good friend's wife, and she had six children, and then she had six more children, my mother being the last. And that picture's my mother, and that's me, the little one. Yeah, go ahead. We're going now. Next photo. That's my grandma. You see her there? She's with my sister, Janice, and my grandma is ready to go to town. You can see she has her purse in her hand, she has her cane, she has her coat on, and her bandana. It's interesting to me to look at her that way because she always told me not to wear a bandana to town and not to wear sweaters tied up, what do you call it, cardigans, because you look like, now this is terrible, but you look like an upriver engine.
What?
Yeah, she said that because she wanted me to blend in with all the white people in town. So she didn't want me to know how to speak any of the Indian words. She wouldn't give me any. I'd ask her. She wouldn't. She talked Indian. She talked five languages, one being English, so four Indian ones, two Athabascan and two Algonquin. So she had a mixture of languages that she could speak, but she wouldn't pass the words on because it would be dangerous. And Grandpa, every once in a while, he'd slip a word to me, but that was about it. Next slide. This is in the this is the house that Grandpa built out of that wood from the Pebble Beach. And in this picture, you see in the front row Agnes Matz and Fanny Dave. Fanny Rubin Dave is a sister to my grandma, who's standing in front of my brother on the your right side. And then my grandpa's in the chair. My grandpa was blind from, started getting blind in the 40s, and he lived to be 92. So he was blind for quite a while, and he lived with us off and on every other month. That room, that room held a healing ceremony with the Indian doctor for me. I got very ill when I was 7 years old, and I was in the hospital, and I was given up to die. And Aunt Fanny came from Aetna, and they had an Indian doctor with them, and they did Indian singing and doctoring in the house for me while I was in the hospital. And meanwhile, my dad is calling his sister, who's a nurse in Spokane, Washington. And she says, "Fly her tomorrow morning to Spokane. We have a doctor here at Shriners Hospital." And so I spent time in Shriners Hospital, then with my aunt in her home, and then came back, and I was in bed for 2 years and on a diet for five. So that's another spiritual thing that happened. And during that time, while I was sick, I was terrified because I heard my grandpa and my mom talking about it, and most people die from what I had. And I heard them say that. They were worried, and they were talking about it. So I cried myself to sleep every night. But they always said prayers with me at night. You know, now I lay me down to sleep, and then you pray whatever else you want to pray. Okay, so I started praying. I started praying. And all of a sudden, after a while, I wasn't crying anymore. I wasn't even worried. Oh, yeah. Go on. I have more slides, I think. Next. When things loosened up, like I told you, they prayed in that room. They did the singing and dancing. They kept the kids outside. Kids had to be locked outside on the porches because it's too dangerous if they learn how to do these things. So, but when it opened up again toward the 60s, you know, civil rights movement and early 70s, we started getting dances coming back. And so that's a brush dance pit. And that would have been my chance for me to dance. I never did get to dance. I had a dress I was going to get to wear it. Somebody else grabbed the dress before I got there to put it on, so I didn't get to wear it. And I always worried about that. Go on. Next slide. Yeah. Now, that's my granddaughter. Our granddaughter. I better correct that quick. That's Jessica. She's graduating from high school, by the way, Catherine, on the 13th in Arcata High. And she has danced everywhere. We're still borrowing dresses. The only regalia that our family had was put into the museum to preserve it because people were stealing regalia. And we didn't want to lose it. So it went into the museum in Crescent City. It's a good museum. That was probably the last elders' gathering. There's discussion that there might not be another one. That's the one that's held at Redwood Acres. Okay. I think that's my last slide. Next. No. Yeah.
All right. This is a little out of order, but that's okay. This is a picture of my great grandfather and grandmother's. They're in there with their children, and my grandmother is in there as well. So that just gives you a picture of. I know that my family has a lot of portrait type of things, so that's what I'll share this morning. So that's my great-grandparents' family. Next slide. That is my great-grandmother. She's sitting on the ground, and she's making baskets. I have seen baskets, and I have seen regalia, but I do not have any possession of it. I have a few items that were passed on to me, but that is a picture, and she's over in Quartz Valley making a basket. Next slide. That's a picture of the basket collection. You can see there's quite a few baskets, and they're scattered throughout the family. At one time, I did go to the Trees of Mystery, and I saw some baskets that were up there that were made by the supers. And then I visited at another time, and they were gone, and nobody could tell me where those baskets went. So maybe they were returned to the family. I don't know. But you can see there's quite an extensive collection of baskets. Next slide. That is my grandmother. She's the one that raised the four children on her own, and she had a lot of support from her family. Her name's Dosa, and she didn't speak much Native American. As far as I understand, she died when I was almost 2 years old, so I didn't really know my grandmother. Next slide. There is a picture of my great-grandparents, my grandmother's mother and father over in Quartz Valley. That's Joe and Trina Super. Next slide. There's a picture of my mother when she had earned her cap after she had gone through the French's Hospital and did her nurse's training, and that's a picture of her graduation. I have to say that I'm very proud of my mother. She was my rock throughout my life. She's the one that encouraged me whenever I had to fill out any kind of paperwork and you had to check the box that said, what is your ethnicity? She told me to always mark the box that said Native American, which really paid off in my lifetime because of doing that, I received the Maple Creek Willie Indian Scholarship Fund, which I found out Sharon also received. So that helped us go to college when we were younger, of course. And later on, I was a member of ITEP, which is the Indian Teacher Education Project here at Humboldt State. So because of my claim to the Native American side of my family, I was able to obtain my education, and I am where I am today. I'm so thankful for my mother and all that she did. Growing up, we only learned a few words in Indian, and some of them I probably can't tell you, but her nickname was Niffy. She was called Niffy because when she was little, she always had a sniffy nose, so her uncle called her Niffy, and so many of the family call her Niffy. When I was growing up, when I was 5 years old, it was just my mother and myself because she had left my father. And I remember at 5 years old, every night we would say the Lord's Prayer. And I remember that. I don't know how well I said it, but I do remember at the end because I would bless my family, my friends, the birds, the flowers, everything I could think of, and it went on and on and on. So by the time I was five, or approximately 5 years old, I knew the Lord's Prayer.
I guess I'm going to jump back for a minute. My parents married in 1941. My dad is white, mostly English, when they were getting married, my grandmother, the one you saw pictured, wouldn't go to the wedding. It was going to be in the parsonage of the Methodist Church. And she wouldn't go. She was not going to go. She was stubborn about it. She said she didn't want her marrying a white man. And my aunt Margaret, she said, "I'll buy a brand new hat for you if you'll go to the wedding." And so Grandma loved hats, so she went to the wedding. And I know that she held on to that because my first boyfriend, I brought him over to see her and meet her, and that was when I was a freshman in high school. And afterwards she said, "What are you doing with that white boy?" And she said, and this is where the prejudice from the other side comes in, she said, "Now, there's a nice young man called Jimmy. He's up the street here. He helps his grandma. He cuts wood. He does all those things for grandma. And that's who you should be with. He's also half white." So she was choosing somebody that was something like me, I guess. But we attended the Methodist Church. My mother took us there to the church. I was through MYF, all the different, I don't know, activities of the church, but then they quit going, and I kept going to the church. And I asked my mom about the differences because my grandpa's family went to a different church. My grandma would go to the Four Square Church. She'd go to the Indian Shaker Church. Of course, she went to Indian things, and it just didn't matter because everything was spiritual. And so everybody had faith. And so my mom said, "It's okay. You can go." And I did my experimentation too. I visited several denominations and thought about why I should be Methodist or not, and chose to be that. I did, as Catherine mentioned, I have had quite a past working with for free with the Methodist Church in the Cal Nevada Conference. I was chair of the Native American Caucus, and then for the Western Jurisdiction, I was chair of the Native American Caucus. I was elected at one annual conference to serve in Western Jurisdiction, and I was elected on the fifth ballot. And between the fourth and fifth ballot, a small delegation, two or three people, came to my table where I was sitting at annual conference and said, "Sharon, we want you to know we're going to throw our ballots to you because we appreciate that you have their votes, and it was the LGBTQ, now I guess, caucus, that threw their votes to me, and I was elected then on that next ballot. And that's where that year we were choosing a bishop. But I've been involved in religion and race. I attended a, this sounds weird too, I attended a Klan rally on religion and race because we were checking to see what it was like. That was in Ceres, California. And that I went with Reverend Paul Dierdack. We just, and my Aunt Margaret went with me too. We got there a little late, but we saw the cross and we saw the people. And what really affected me deeply was that the people were very convicted. They were taking off their robes, and you could tell they were all excited, and they really believed firmly what they were espousing in that rally. And that was scary.
I'm going to go back when I was a child, and I was 5 years old. I was learning the Lord's Prayer, but I also remember going to the Methodist Church in Wairika. It was in the basement. It was cold, and I loved it because we colored, we sang songs, and we heard stories. And so that's the beginning of my relationship with the Methodist Church. Then when I was a young child in the 50s, we moved around quite a bit. I think we moved 5 times between Wairika, Medford, and finally ended up in Mount Shasta. And I did graduate from Mount Shasta High School. So when I was in Mount Shasta, I became very involved with MYF, the Methodist Youth Fellowship, which really brought me a lot of joy. I remember one day, and this is when I believe that I accepted my Lord. I was at the altar. I was on my knees. My mother and father had separated before I was 2 years old, so my mother was my everything. But I found there was something else in my life which was much greater. And as I was on my knees, and I was praying, and I felt a very warm, comforting embrace. I don't know where it came from, but I know that was my God. And so from then on, I have been a very strong believer in my God. So MYF was a lot of fun, and I found out later that my mother belonged to the Epworth League, which I believe was a youth group for the Methodists during her time. I don't really know about the Epworth League. I meant to look it up. So she was also involved with the Methodism when she was a child or when she was a teenager. And so that was my exposure and beginning of my path on my religion. I graduated from Mount Shasta High, and then it was time to make decisions and where I was going to go, what was going to happen. And I had heard about the Maple Creek Willie Indian Scholarship Fund. I applied, and as I said, I did receive that one. So I did go to junior college for 2 years, and then I took a break, had a family, and went back later and finished and got my teaching education at Humboldt State. So that brings you through my history. I have a few more photos to show, if you'd show the slides. That's a picture of my mother. That was the most recent picture of her. She's a beautiful woman. I love her. Next slide. That is a picture of, that was a Karuk reunion and happy camp. That was probably about 2010. My mother is sitting on the very right. In the middle is a woman with the 3 stripes on her chin. That's Generate Jacobs Johnny. That's Terry Supaha's mother. He spoke to you a couple weeks ago. And those two are cousins. And then the woman on the far left, I'm not sure who she is. Speaking of relations, as Sharon and I were doing this project, I think we might be related.
People had to marry outside of their village into other areas. Plus, there were a lot of people were killed. So, obviously, there were people getting together in different places. So, we even were related to Terry. Well, you are. So,
yeah, Terry's a cousin through marriages. All right, next slide.
I think that's it.
Oh, is that it? Okay.
Yeah, well, that's it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. That's it.
Well, I have a little bit at the end of my presentation that I wanted to share with you, and I want to quote Psalm 67, verse 6 and 7. It says, "For the earth has yielded abundant harvests. God, even our own God, will bless us, and peoples from the remotest lands will worship him." And the Native Americans and the Karuks, when they began their day and when they ended their day, many times they would do that with a song, which was actually a prayer. And in that song or their prayer, they were saying things and they were praying to keep a good heart, to not think badly of other people, and to be kind and respectful of the elder. Yutva. Thank you.